This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia. Notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental
or additional to
the main topic in the margin of a book.
Irish author Maggie O'Farrell is best known for her fiction, with a half dozen novels on her bibliography. But her newest work is nonfiction, a collection of essays about her brushes with death. The title of the book is from a line in Sylvia Plath's The Bell Jar, and sounds like the old brag of a heart. I am, I am, I am. I recently spoke with Maggie O'Farrell via Skype about the memoir and her first foray into nonfiction. I'm Beth Golay, this is Marginalia, and here's our conversation.
If this book were fiction, it would be a connected collection of stories. But as nonfiction, it's a connected group of memories. As the subtitle 17 Brushes with Death suggests, these memories are of near-death experiences. 16 are yours, and one is your daughter's. How were you able to so vividly recall your 16 brushes with death, and what made you decide to chronicle a bit of your life through them?
Well, I never really planned to write a memoir. It wasn't something that I had envisaged for myself at all. You know, I feel very wedded to the form of fiction. Fiction has always been what I wanted to do. I never really wanted to do it. But I have always thought that, you know, in a sense, you don't choose the books choose you. And certainly with this one, it was very strongly the case, because I enjoy reading memoir, but I never wanted to do it for two reasons, really. That, firstly, I always thought it was an enormous tax on your friends and families. You know, writing about yourself is one thing, you know, because you have control over it. There's a reason why the words author and authority come from the same root. but, you know, the other people in your life don't have any agency or control over what you say about them. And also the idea, the sort of chronological structure of most memoirs never interested or engaged me at all as a writer, and in a kind of artistic sense. I don't find chronology hugely interesting. You know, I would never have wanted to write a memoir that began with, you know, I was born in Northern Ireland and then I went to school and then I'd find plodding through that sort of very rigid structure quite depressing. So I think coming up with the structure for the book, which is 17 separate chapters or essays in a kind of non-chronological structure, because they're not organised in terms of time, they're arranged in terms of body parts and sort of thematically, you know, I put chapters together that kind of seem to me to have an interesting dialogue next to each other. In that way, it was enormously liberating, because I realised that with that structure, with the non-chronological and these kind of flashes of moments in time, it was, you know, there was an awful lot that I could put in. There was an awful lot that I didn't have to put in. You know, there are lots and lots of things that aren't in the book, and it's possible to sort of skip 10 or 5 or 10 years and it doesn't seem odd to the reader. It doesn't make the narrative feel broken. And also it was a way in which I could be very careful about other people's identities and lives, you know, because nobody in the book has their real name apart from my husband, actually. Everybody else is either anonymous or has a pseudonym. It was a way that I could, in a kind of technical sense, not name my siblings, for example. So if I was writing chronologically, it would seem bizarre not to give your, you know, the names of my sisters, for example. But in this way, it's possible for me to do that. So that was very liberating. It allowed me to continue in this kind of, this my first and maybe only foray into nonfiction.
As you mentioned, these essays are not told in chronological order, and I'm afraid my questions jump around a bit too.
Oh, that's fine. I'm quite used to that.
in that same essay that I mentioned before, in Cerebellum 1980, when you were hospitalized as a young child with encephalitis, you overheard a young patient and his nurse outside your door. The boy was being a little too loud, and the nurse said to him, "Hush, there's a little girl dying in there." You wrote that scene into your third novel, and you chose that part to read aloud at public events. And you remarked in the memoir that it was an odd choice. But I think when I read that quote, that's when I released my loudest audible gasp. Did your readers for the novel and do your readers for the memoir, do they react the same way I did? I mean, I really think that's where I went.
Yes. I mean, looking back on it now, you know, however many years ago it was when I was, I see, it was before my son was born, so it's at least 15 years ago that I was doing events for that book. You know, and the person I am now, I just look back on her and think, what were you thinking? You know, why would you read that chapter? But I think maybe when you are reading, when you're choosing the excerpt that you're going to read an event, I suppose you're reading something that you want to draw the audience in and you want to surprise them. But, you know, I don't think anybody in any of those events knew that actually that story was true and it was based on something that had happened to me. You know, it was probably the only one of the very, very, very few times that I had put something real into my fiction, because I don't think of myself as an autobiographical fiction writer, not at all. I much prefer to make things up. It doesn't really appeal to me to transpose real life into fiction at all. But no, it does sort of amaze. It does sort of surprise me looking back as to why I did it. But it was true. I mean, I think probably the reason why I did it is because it did have an impact. I think readers were shocked to hear that read aloud. I mean, but I don't know how much more shocked they would have been if I'd divulged it. Actually, it was all completely true.
In The Whole Body, 1993, the brush with death occurred when you were on a flight over the Pacific heading to Hong Kong. There was trouble with the plane and many of the passengers were injured. You walked away with, and I quote, a novena of bruises from the impressions of rosary beads pressed into your side, and the rosary belonged to the priest who was sitting next to you. And you had just left Cambridge, you were no longer pursuing a PhD, and you had the realization that you could read whatever you wanted. And not only could you read what you felt like, you could. That's when you started writing. Can you talk to me a little bit about that time in your life and how that felt?
It was a very, very strange time in my life, because as you say, I just graduated, and I had intended to continue. I'd intended to stay on at university at Cambridge and to do a PhD, but actually I messed up my final exams. I'm not really quite sure why, actually. Even now I don't really know what happened, but I thought, and my tutors thought, I would get one mark, which meant that I would get funding and which meant I could carry on to do postgraduate studies, but actually I didn't get anywhere near it. Something went really badly wrong, and that was, I was absolutely devastated. I mean, at that time, it felt like the worst thing that had ever happened to me. This kind of future that I thought I had mapped out as an academic was just completely snatched away from me. And I had to very, very quickly think what I was going to do and rethink what I was going to do. And I decided, which is the kind of decision you make when you're 21. You know, I had absolutely no money. I didn't speak any languages and I thought I should travel. And I had a friend who was out in Hong Kong and he'd said, why don't you come here? You know, you'll be able to get some kind of job. And it seemed like the right thing to do. So I just left the UK and flew to Hong Kong with just a rucksack. And basically, I don't even know how much money I had, but it was certainly less than £50, or, you know, $50 or so to live on. But, you know, I think that's, you can do those things when I was 21. And actually, it was the best thing that I could have done, it turns out. You know, but I was deep in grief because I really wanted, you know, I had this subject that I wanted to do for my PhD, which was about the medieval poem Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. And I had thought that's what I was going to spend the next few years doing and possibly the rest of my life. I wanted to be an academic and to teach and to research and study. But things didn't turn out that way. And actually, I went to Hong Kong. And as you were saying, I joined a library, I joined the British Council Library. And I realized that I could read whatever I wanted, which felt like a revelation, you know, because I'd been in school and I'd been at university and I'd been going through curriculums and courseworks and reading lists. And suddenly I had this moment of liberation and I could read anything. And it is, I mean, I had written a lot before that, but that was the first time when I started writing with quite a serious focus, when I was reading quite a lot of modern fiction, which isn't something you necessarily read when you're studying literature as a degree. And I began to see what it was possible, what it was capable of, what these people, you know, people like Angela Carter, were writing about. I thought, well, maybe I could try it. Maybe I could give it a go. So it was the first time I'd actually sat down with a serious intent of thinking what I wanted to say and how I wanted to say it.
I just recently went back to school to get my English literature degree. And,
oh, did you? Congratulations.
Thanks. I'm only doing it one class at a time. I mean, I have a
That's fine.
I have a degree in business and marketing.
You can take your time.
But I get to class early and then I'm always reading a book for this, you know, usually for the podcast, sometimes for a book club or what have you. And these mm-hmm. students who are all traditional in age and everything, they come in and they say, you're reading something? What? And they'll tell me they haven't read a book for pleasure in 4 years and they don't know. I mean, it's kind of funny. So when you were, you know, when you wrote that essay, I thought, this is how those kids feel.
I often think, God, I wish I could go back and do my degree all over again. I'd be much more serious and I think I'd be more relaxed but more focused at the same time. I think mm-hmm. you're probably doing it the right way around. I think it was probably wasted on me aged 18.
Water plays a large role in your life. Can you talk to me about your need for the sea, especially since three of your brushes with death were near drownings?
Well, it's funny. I've always lived close to the sea. I was born by the sea, and up until the age when I left home, I've always lived by the sea. I've always felt, I don't know why, it's always felt like a bit of a kind of necessity to me. I live now in Edinburgh, which of course is on the sea, so I can drive for 20 minutes and I'm at a beach. And I've always loved swimming. You know, I'm physically not very strong because, you know, my encephalitis, I have quite a few physical overhangs and physical and neurological overhangs from that. So I'm not a particularly physically strong person, but I've always loved to swim, and I will swim at any opportunity in pretty cold water, actually. So, yes, but I think, you know, having that experience of nearly dying when I was a child and overhearing somebody say that I was dying, I think when you hear that as a young child, I mean, I think when you hear it at any point in your life, it changes you. You know, obviously it completely changes your outlook on who you are and what's going to happen to you. But I think as a child, it sort of, that knowledge takes up residence inside you, because I hadn't really realized until that point that I was dying, or that everyone thought I was dying. Because, of course, you know, as a child, the doctors don't talk to you. They won't tell you these things. They tell them to your parents, but they don't tell them to you. So your role as a child, if you're sick in hospital, is to try and glean from conversations and hints and overheard bits of speech what's happening to you. And so hearing that and then knowing that I had, for whatever reason, managed to find a loophole out of that destiny, I've always lived ever since then with the sense that my life is a kind of gift. It's a boon. And I wasn't meant to be alive, but I am. And so I always have lived with this knowledge, and it's made me want to just live the biggest and the best life I possibly can within whatever physical and neurological strictures that I have. But it also has meant, I think, that I have taken a lot more risks than maybe I should have done, you know, because it's just, I wanted to experience everything I possibly could. And I'm not going to let a slight incapacities that I have stop me doing anything I can. So I think that's why I've got into trouble quite a lot with the sea. I would like to say I'm much more careful these days. Now I have three children, I am very aware that I have people relying on me. So I am a lot more sensible than I used to be.
You wrote about some pretty personal topics: miscarriage, infertility, your perceived failings as a mother. Many women would find it difficult to talk about any of these topics publicly. In fact, in an interview you gave with Ella Walker for the Irish Times, you said, "A novel feels like creation, and this felt like excavation." And then you added, "I don't know how cathartic it was." How do you still feel that way?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it felt very, very different to writing my novels, certainly. I mean, I think in one sense, I was surprised how similar it was, but in a very kind of micro detail, it's very similar, because obviously a paragraph is a paragraph and you still construct the sentence in exactly the same way and you punctuate it. And on that kind of micro level, it felt oddly familiar. It just felt like everything else I'd ever written. And I suppose in a sense, you know, because I am a novelist, I did approach it in the kind of sense of, I suppose you'd call it the narrative arc. I approached that as I would a novel. I didn't differentiate in any sense. You know, that's why I was always very sure of the structure of it, and I knew that the penultimate chapter would be about my illness as a child and the last chapter would be about my daughter, because it seemed to me that there was those two chapters needed to be together, and they also needed to be at the end, because in a sense those two chapters are the explanation for really my whole life and also the whole book. You know, obviously the last chapter about my daughter's life-threatening medical condition, it is obviously the reason why I've written the book and why it is I'm thinking about mortality and what it is that near-death experiences do to us. And so I suppose in that way I did. But obviously everything else about the book was completely different and completely new. And it really does feel like excavation. You know, I would find quite frequently that I would be falling into my habits, my sort of fiction novel writing habits. And I'd be writing a scene and I'd sense myself thinking, you know, if I could just move this all to France, or if I could bring in a man at this point. And I think, oh no, I can't do that because I have to stick to the truth. You know, the truth, in a sense, in one way, it's easier to write about because you don't have to make it up. It's all there. It's all present. But in other ways, it's harder because you have to, it wasn't so much the mining myself for details in the past or like finding it painful. It wasn't really that at all. It was more the kind of sense of how much you can say and how much you can't. And also, you know, you, with any memoir, I realise, or anything nonfiction, you run up again and again against this idea of the ownership of narrative, which in a novel, it doesn't occur at all because obviously you're making it up. But with this sense, you know, there are scenes in which there are other people in it, or there are other people's stories coming into it. You know, with the chapter about my daughter, I had to be very, very careful, you know, because even though she was six when I wrote it, and I could say to her, is it okay if I write about it? She'd say, oh, yes, but, you know, she doesn't still even have any real sense of what it means to have been written about in a book. So it was very important to me that I didn't impinge on her story, because, of course, the story of her condition and what she goes through is hers to tell if she chooses to do so in the future. So the chapter just, it had to be about my experience of what it's like being her mother. And I couldn't write about how she might have felt. I couldn't extrapolate her experience because that belongs to her. And also the first chapter in which I write about meeting a man in the mountains that I felt was going to harm me. That in a way, in a technical sense, was the trickiest chapter to write because I felt very strongly that the narrative of that story belonged to the other girl. Not me, you know, I'm just a footnote really in what happened in that chapter. And I was determined to write it in such a way that I concealed where it happened, and because I didn't want the family and the friends of that girl to recognize it, because, you know, the way in which she dies, I cannot literally imagine a worse way to die. And the very last thing I wanted to do with that chapter was to reawaken their pain. Because how might it feel if that had happened to your daughter or your sister or your friend, and you open a book 30 years later and you discover that someone's writing about it and it could have happened to somebody else, you know? So the very, very last thing I wanted to do was to reveal it, you know, for them to recognise it and to be able to identify it and the man, because that story belongs to her. It doesn't belong to me. And I think that was a revelation, because I'd never really thought about ownership of narrative before, but that's something. And, you know, I think writing every book teaches you something, or it teaches you lots of things, but that's something that certainly I learned while I was writing this.
Well, we've talked about a lot. Is there anything that you'd like to add that we haven't covered?
I think the only thing which I realised, the other thing I realised about writing with this book is that actually, although the subtitle says death, that actually the book for me is about life. It's about the life lived around those moments that we all have. You know, I think everybody has near-death experiences, some more than others and some more serious than others. But you know, for me, the book is about not so much about what death means to us, but about what life means to us. And I think that's what comes up in those moments when you feel your life is in danger. I think you think about why you need to stay and what you have to stay for, what it means, what your life means to you, and why you want to cling to it so tightly.
That was Maggie O'Farrell, author of the book I Am, I Am, I Am, 17 Brushes with Death, which was published by Knopf. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. Discover new episodes at kmuw.org or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. And if you enjoy this podcast, please consider rating or reviewing it on iTunes. Marginalia is produced at KMUW Wichita. Our editor is Luann Stevens, and I am the producer. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.